Robin Young, it's here and now. In a moment, the Iraqi government wants to remove the immunity granted to U.S. contract workers in Iraq. Well, two journalists say that's going to be impossible because it would provoke too many cases of fraud and abuse. But first, O.J. Simpson is back in the headlines and back in the courtroom. The former football star appeared in a Las Vegas courtroom today to face 11 criminal charges in connection with his alleged role in the armed robbery of sports memorabilia last week. Justice of the Peace Joe Bonaventure Jr. read the complaint against Simpson.
This charges you with the crimes of conspiracy to commit a crime, a gross misdemeanor offense, conspiracy to commit kidnapping, a felony offense, conspiracy to commit robbery, a felony offense, burglary while in possession of deadly weapon, a felony offense, two counts of first-degree kidnapping with use of a deadly weapon, both felony offenses, two counts of robbery with use of a deadly weapon, both felony offenses, two counts of assault with use of a deadly weapon, both felony offenses, and coercion with use of a deadly weapon, a felony offense. Mr. Simpson, do you understand the charges against you?
Yes, sir.
Bail was set at $125,000 with several conditions, among them that Simpson surrender his passport, that he not have any contact with potential witnesses or co-defendants. Simpson did not enter a plea. The Heisman Trophy winner, who was acquitted in the 1994 killings of his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her friend Ron Goldman, but later lost in a wrongful death civil suit, was arrested after a sports memorabilia collector reported a group of armed men, including Simpson, charged into his Las Vegas hotel room last Thursday and took several items Simpson claimed belonged to him. Johnny Griffin III is a former federal prosecutor and a defense attorney in Sacramento, California, a frequent commentator on high-profile legal cases, and this is certainly one. He's on the line with us now. Johnny, we would not be covering this, more than likely, if it were not O.J. Simpson. First of all, explain to us, how does this work? We understand Simpson is asked to pay $125,000 in bail, but then the parents of Ron Goldman won a $33.5 million wrongful death judgment against Simpson. There was some speculation that that bail money should go to them.
Right, and I understand that concern, but typically when a bail amount is ordered, that person does not have to pay that in cash. And as the judge said here, he said cash or surety, and the surety means you use a bail bondsman. And here, more than likely, and this is my understanding, that a bondsman was there in court prepared to post the bond, which means that O.J. would only have to pay, generally speaking, around 10% of the bond amount, about $12,500. We all know that O.J. gets a pension, so more than likely the funds that would be used to pay that bond premium would be either from a pension or from family, friends, or supporters.
And what about the memorabilia itself? I know we're way away from parsing this out, but do the Goldmans lay claim to that as well?
Well, it's my understanding, actually, here in California, down in Los Angeles, I believe that the Goldman family and the attorneys are in the process of trying to get some type of court order to gain possession or legal ruling as to who's entitled to those memorabilia.
And we understand the judge said that the Goldmans have a week to put together a list of the memorabilia. A complicating factor on the prosecutor's side in this current case, one of the alleged victims, one of the collectors, had a heart attack this week and has been hospitalized. Your thoughts on this case? Legal analysts are flocking around it because it is of such interest. Why? What do you see some of the interesting or complicated aspects of it being?
Well, one of the first issues, obviously, is that it involves O.J., okay? Mm-hmm. Secondly, in terms of just purely a legal standpoint, is the whole issue, can one be guilty of, quote-unquote, stealing their own property or taking back their own property? That's going to raise some issues. But here, the big issue that O.J. faces is how he went about reclaiming his own property, if in fact it was his own property. There are lawful ways to do that. Then there's going to be a dispute as to literally what happened while in that hotel room. And then we have the recording, and the issue is going to be the admissibility of that recording. And both sides perhaps may want that recording in to demonstrate various views as to what happened and what didn't happen.
This is a recording in which O.J. Simpson and others are alleged to say, that's my stuff, you know, yelling in the room that they, you know, that they want to take the things away. And, of course, that all brings us back to whose things these items are, who they belong to.
Exactly. Another thing, Robin, we know that the kidnapping charge did not come out until after the tape was made available to law enforcement, and it's the wording on that tape that tended to corroborate what these alleged victims were saying, i.e. that their freedom was restrained, they couldn't leave, and or they were told to move here or move there or do that.
It's a pretty serious charge.
Exactly. Frankly, that's perhaps one of the most serious charges, the kidnapping with an arm, with a weapon.
Johnny Griffin III, former federal prosecutor, a defense attorney in Sacramento, California. So we will see how this plays out over the next few weeks. Johnny, thanks so much.
Great. Thanks, Robin.
Congressman Henry Waxman, chair of the Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, is investigating whether the State Department tried to derail investigations of possible fraud and abuse in Iraq and Afghanistan. Waxman sent the department's Inspector General, Howard Krongard, a 14-page letter accusing him of ignoring whistleblower charges and seeking to support the Bush administration rather than serve as an objective check on waste and fraud. Krongard calls the allegations replete with inaccuracies. Well, separately, the American Embassy in Iraq has suspended diplomatic missions outside of the Green Zone after security guards for the private contractor Blackwater USA accompanying an American motorcade were accused of firing on Iraqi civilians, killing a couple and their child. The shooting on Sunday has set off a furious debate in Iraq about private security companies, which were given the privilege of working outside Iraqi law. A spokesperson for the Iraqi government today says they'd like to review that protection. Well, charges of abuse of power and fraud against American contractors in Iraq are not new. Between April 2003 and June 2004, $12 billion were airlifted to Baghdad, and more than 3 years later, $9 billion of that remains unaccounted for. The story of what may have happened to that money is told in the recent issue of Vanity Fair magazine by two Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporters. They join us now from the studios of WRTI in Philadelphia. We welcome Donald Bartlett. Donald, welcome.
Good to be with you.
And James Steele. James, welcome to you as well.
Nice to be with you, Robin.
And I want your comments first on especially the news about the Blackwater security guards. Your thoughts on that, Donald?
Well, as we disclosed in the Vanity Fair piece, one of the last acts that Paul Bremer did before he left Baghdad was to issue this order, basically a get-out-of-jail-card-free to anybody who did anything illegal during the days of the Coalition Provisional Authority. And this is one reason, despite enormous fraud in tens of billions, if not hundreds of billions of dollars, there's been very little action taken by the U.S. government and no action by the Iraqis because they have been barred from doing so.
Well, James, you know, you say get out of jail free card. It was essentially saying that contractors, those who had worked for U.S. forces, would be immune from prosecution.
Immune from prosecution, and therefore, I mean, this is why the Coalition Provisional Authority was such an unusual and just basically a rogue agency. It was absolutely ideally set up as a kind of sieve for cash because it didn't exist long, and at the end of this, Bremer issues this regulation that basically puts all those contractors off the hook, and this is part of what's involved in the whole Blackwater situation because the Iraqis are told that they really have no authority to go after some of the contractors in some of these cases. This is why the mess that's over there is just so staggering. It goes back to the very beginning of the invasion and everything that followed it and why it's going to take us a long time to get this whole thing cleaned up.
Well, let's try to sort it out a little bit. The Coalition Provisional Authority, headed by Paul Bremer, lasted for about a year. There was confusion about, you know, exactly what that organization was. Tell us.
It had no legitimate underpinnings in Congress. Here's an agency that's created that will be whose operations were paid for by U.S. taxpayers, yet there are no documents recording its creation. In fact, it really was a rogue agency.
But who exactly set it up?
Well, it was really formed on the basis of an order issued by General Franks on his way into Baghdad, and he issued this decree creating it, and that was it.
As he was going into Baghdad, there was, as you write, chaos. There was a sense that money had to be gotten into the hands of desperate Iraqis soon or there would be more chaos. Isn't some of this just the fog of war?
A certain amount of it is the fog of war, but the creation of this entity was something totally unusual, something totally unique. Even if you go to the U.S. Congress, half the congressmen think that it's a branch of the U.S. government. You go to the United Nations, they think it's somehow related to the U.S. government. Some in Congress think it's a U.N. agency. The confusion over this was just palpable. And the point we make in the piece, because of the way they did this, it set up a perfect sieve for the money that came in. No accountability, no tracking of it. I mean, if you were writing a spy thriller and you wanted to create the right kind of entity to let this kind of money disappear, you couldn't have done a better job than to create something called the CPA.
You might make the fog of war argument in Baghdad, but this was done in a cold, deliberate way within the Pentagon in Washington. It had nothing to do with the fog of war.
Well, to underscore that, let's tell the story of an attempt to account for some of the money, because as you're right, there didn't seem to be any accounting. And then at one point, a company named North Star Consultants, which calls itself an accounting firm, is hired by the CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority, and at one point paid $4 million for accountant and audit services. You tracked down North Star Consultants. What did you find?
North Star Consultants operates out of a private home in La Jolla, California, a suburb of San Diego. When you look at the creation of this company, the CPA was calling for a certified public accountant to look at the books, to watch these billions of dollars being airlifted into Iraq. But North Star, by its own couple of admissions, has no accountants.
Well, it had no staff at all.
Whatever it had, it was not certainly a traditional company. The company was founded, incorporated originally in the Bahamas. That has been the focal point of all kind of tax avoidance, offshore tax activity, off and on for years.
But when you tracked down another address that you found a husband and wife living, as you said, in this house in La Jolla, and also registered to that house was a home renovation company. You got this gentleman who was the president of this North Star Consultants on the phone. How did he tell you he got this bid for overseeing the accounting of funds in Iraq when, in fact, his company seemed to be home renovation? How did he get this contract?
He maintained that he saw this on the internet and he bid on the job. Beyond that, he refused to discuss any part of it. He took the position that I can't discuss an issue unless my customer gives me approval. His customer in this case was the Pentagon and the CBA. And he said that he had spoken to them, that he'd been hoping that somebody would talk to us, but in fact they didn't have anybody who could discuss this. They considered this a closed issue. In other words, the fact that $12 billion is airlifted into Iraq and the vast bulk of it vanishes, the Pentagon considers that a closed case. He refused to discuss his company. He refused to discuss in any detail what he did over there, if anything.
Well, you detail several cases of fraud. We've heard some of these through hearings on the Hill and through other writing. But let's see, only 600 of 8,000 guards drawing CPA paychecks could be accounted for. Halliburton charged the CPA for 42,000 daily meals for soldiers but served only 14,000. Cash is, you know, handed out from the backs of pickup trucks. How is this possible, Donald?
Well, again, it goes back to no oversight. Zero. North Star was supposed to be the agency that made sure the money was properly spent. All of this is coming out of this post office box in the Bahamas from which the Pentagon gave the contract to make sure money in Iraq did not disappear. It was very curious.
Donald Bartlett and James Steele, two Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporters who write in the October issue of Vanity Fair about the $9 billion missing in Iraq. When we come back, we'll hear about another company, well, two young guys, really, receiving millions of dollars to run civilian flights in and out of Baghdad. There were no civilian flights in Baghdad. Later in the show today, a call for 10,000 men to patrol the streets of Philadelphia. Isn't that the job of police? Back after a break here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporters Donald Bartlett and James Steele. Their article in the October issue of Vanity Fair, Billions Over Baghdad, chronicles fraud and corruption in Iraq during the reign of the U.S.-run Coalition Provisional Authority. We've just heard about North Star, the so-called accounting firm that was paid $1.4 million to provide accounting and audit services. North Star was a shell. There were no accountants, a house in La Jolla. And you detail another company called Custer Battles. This is Scott Custer and Jim Battles, both former Army Rangers in their mid-30s. Battles had also been a CIA operative and in 2002 a failed Republican candidate for Congress in Rhode Island. They got a contract, the first no-bid contract, to protect civilian aircraft flights at the Baghdad airport. Very few of those. How did they get that contract? Because, as you write, there was no company. They had no money, no employees. How much did they get?
By the end of the first year, they had $100 million in contracts lined up for a variety of purposes, including the distribution of the new Iraqi money.
Did, when they first got the contract, did they have employees? Did they have a track record? Did they? What did they have?
Well, there's certainly no track record. They showed up in the streets of Baghdad at a time when you couldn't, ordinary people couldn't get to Baghdad unless they had the approval of the White House. So it's some indication of how they got their business.
One interesting thing about Custer Battles is one of the people we interviewed who had been in Iraq at the time, who'd been instructed to basically make a payment to Custer Battles, and this gets to the heart of the cash. The fellow comes back to his office in the presidential compound in Baghdad in the Green Zone, second floor. There out on his desk is stacked $2 million in shrink-wrapped $100 bills. And he's told that basically this is a payment to Custer Battles. And there was so much money, he actually had to tell the Custer Battles people, the only way you can carry this out here is you bring a sack with you.
Is this Frank Willis?
Frank Willis.
You know, you also, he tells you how, you know, people like himself who'd gone to Iraq to try to help, he was an advisor to the Iraqi Transportation Ministry, you know, how they reacted to seeing this money. I mean, at one point they were playing football with it. What was the scene he described?
Well, like most of us in this world, I mean, we don't see bundles of cash. I mean, the cash was bundled up in these shrink-wrapped packages called bricks. I think of bricks as something made out of clay and so forth, but over there, bricks were made out of $100 bills and shrink-wrapped. And they had none of them had ever seen this much money just with the naked eye. So they actually threw it around the office, just kind of playing fun with it in that sense. And Frank, being from Oklahoma, said that they were playing football with it. But you couldn't throw a spiral with it, but you could make it spin. But this was kind of the amusing part of it, but it was a deadly serious issue at stake there, which is that suddenly they were turning over $2 million to this contractor, Custer Battles, which was responsible for monitoring civil aircraft flights into Baghdad, for which there were none. That was just one contractor. There were many others and many other divisions that received money. The most significant amount of the money went very often to Iraqi ministries, where the Americans, under the instructions of the CPA, would turn over this money to the Ministry of Finance, the Ministry of Trade, and all they got from them in return was a receipt. It was up to the Iraqis to decide where that money went. And if you talk to people over there, as we did, who were there at the time, they said most of those Iraqi ministries were complete jokes. The people weren't sure they were going to be there the next week. They thought they might be killed. They thought they might be ousted. What most of them were concerned about was not building up Iraq as a nation, but was taking care of themselves and their families. So from day one, this thing was doomed over there. And the money, which was to really be kind of a transition period bit of cash, obviously got to very, very few people.
The other point that Jim made, which is really important here about the whistleblower litigation, Custer Battles was the one and only whistleblower lawsuit to go to trial. And it was scheduled as really the first of a series of cases against Custer Battles. But the jury found for the U.S. government that Custer Battles owed $10 million in repayment. But the judge set aside the verdict and said because the CPA was not a legitimate organization in the U.S. government, the whistleblower statutes would not apply. And this is why we say this cannot be dismissed to the fog of war. This was somebody sitting in the Pentagon very early on, took a look at this and say, okay, how do we protect people? And not just Custer Battles, but a lot of people from any criminal actions or any civil actions, civil lawsuits that might take place, because there are potentially dozens of whistleblower lawsuits hanging out there that are never going to see the light of day because of the illegitimacy of the CPA.
So that's your bottom line. You think that's the way it's going to stay, that they are never going to see the light of day?
The point Don is making, Robin, is really worth emphasizing, and it's especially in contrast to other wars. When you look at, in almost every war, there are abuses when contractors do these things. These things happen. And the interesting thing is, if you go back to World War II, a senator from Missouri, nobody had ever heard of at the time, by the name of Harry Truman, served as kind of the watchdog on contractors throughout World War II, made kind of a name for himself. But this was a war that everybody supported. Everybody knew we had to fight it and so forth. But even then, The feeling was you have to hold their feet to the fire, or there will be abuses, there will be money lost, taxpayers will be ripped off, and so forth. None of that has come out of Washington for this war, where the magnitude of this is really staggering.
In fact, you write, America has spent twice as much in inflation-adjusted dollars to rebuild Iraq as it did to rebuild Japan, which was an industrialized country three times the size of Iraq, with two of its cities incinerated.
Exactly. I mean, it's $29 billion in Iraq versus $15 billion in inflation-adjusted dollars for Japan. So, I mean, this is a serious money, as we're saying here. But the concept of watching people is very deeply ingrained in our system until we get to this war, and nobody's looking at anything.
We've been speaking with James Steele and Donald Bartlett. Their article, Billions Over Baghdad, appears in the current issue of Vanity Fair magazine, from where you can go to our website, here-now.org. Gentlemen, I want to thank you both.
Very nice to be with you, Robin.
Thank you so much, Robin.
And by the way, we mentioned the company Custer Battles, which really was two young men. They were Scott Custer and Michael Battles. I think I may have said Jim. Michael Battles is the name. Still ahead, can citizens help police in Philadelphia patrol the streets? That's after the news, here and now. Young, it's here and now. Leaders in the city of Brotherly Love are calling for 10,000 men to patrol city streets as peacekeepers alongside police in a program that's scheduled to start next month. Last year, 406 people were murdered in Philadelphia, most of them poor and black, the most in 9 years. And the homicide rate is expected to get worse this year. The program, initiated by community leaders, is named 10,000 Men, A Call to Action, It's a New Day, and is being embraced by some local radio hosts and a former Nation of Islam official and the police commissioner. But criminologists have a lot of questions. Philadelphia Police Commissioner Sylvester Johnson joins us now on the line from his office, a 43-year veteran of the police force and a native Philadelphian. He's led the police department for 5 years. Commissioner, welcome.
Glad to be here. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
So tell us, how will the program work? Who are you calling to action, and how will you send them into the streets?
On October the 21st at the Legal Corps Center in Philadelphia, we're going to call them in to come down to the center and sign up. Once they sign up, that's going to be on a Sunday. The following Tuesday, they will report to a school. When they report to the school, they will be designated to train in there. There will be conflict resolution. There'll be other things. There's no arrest powers. There's no confrontations. There's no weapons being carried at all. It's putting a lot of men on the street at one time as peacekeepers.
So who will do the training? Will it be police that will be training these volunteers?
It will be a combination of a lot of people. The police are involved in it. Other community groups can be involved in it. Faith-based community is going to be involved. While they're on the street, there will be a patrol car assigned to this particular area. Say, for example, you have 25, 30 men, whatever the numbers are, while they're out there working a 4x4 block gear, then a car will be available by radio and by phone in case something does happen.
So a couple questions. These volunteers can be men of any color, not necessarily black men, and even though your concern is the high rate of blacks who've been killed. How will people know who they are?
Well, right now, because this is coming to wintertime, what's going to be happening, they'll probably have armbands that will designate so they can wear these armbands whether it's summer, winter, or fall. And our feelings is that if you go to an accident and there's a person, arm is hurting or their leg is hurt, but they're bleeding, you have to put the tourniquet where they're bleeding to stop the bleeding. We understand that there's a lot of social issues that are involved here in the city of Philadelphia, but right now we want to stop the bleeding that's happening right now. 94% of those who are being killed in the city of Philadelphia are high school dropouts. 94% of those who are killing are high school dropouts. 87% of those who are killing or have criminal records, and 84% of those who are being killed have criminal records. So we have to deal with elements we've never dealt with before. We feel as though that law enforcement did not create the problem, and we're not going to be able to solve the problem by ourselves.
But, Commissioner, you've had your critics who've asked, why is this necessary? Isn't this the job of the police? Philadelphia Weekly writer Kia Gregory says it's hard to know whether you've been struggling under Mayor John Street's tight-fisted management, her words, But the newspaper goes on to say that you should have resigned because of the homicide rate on your watch. And Rutgers criminologist Patrick Carr agrees that if you were held to the standards of performance in other jobs, you should resign. How much of what you're doing with this program is offloading what should be the job of police onto citizens?
Well, let me say this. Again, this is not a program that came from me, and I really don't care what Kier Gregory says. If they feel as though that one person controls all the crime that's happened in the city of Philadelphia, it's totally, completely unrealistic. The other thing is the fact that community, law enforcement has been community to step up. Now they're stepping up. Now they're saying we want to be involved. Now we want to join a partnership with you because it has to be a partnership, and we welcome that partnership. I'm going to retire on January the 5th. On January the 6th, I will be out there because the only thing will change will be my title, but my commitment to our community will be exactly the same. There's a lot of people who sit back and do a whole lot of criticism, but they do nothing else but criticize. Let me say this. 44% of our homicides here in the city of Philadelphia are arguments. Let me also say 52% of African-American males in the city of Philadelphia are not working. 53% of the kids that's going to school and in the ninth grade are not graduating from the 12th grade. Law enforcement didn't create the social issues that are involved in our community, and we're not going to be able to solve the crime. This is a program that has originated from the street by doctors, lawyers, music people, all kinds of people are saying, we want to get involved, and we're going to get involved. You know, the fact is that, again, the finger's being pointed at me, which is not a problem. That comes with the territory. But it's not just a Philadelphia problem. It is a national problem. Homeland security is very, very important. But hometown security is just as important.
Well, your union spokesperson, the police union spokesperson, Gene Blagman, says it's a problem of a deployment of cops. The department has too many special units, that there need to be more cops on the street. Again, the Philadelphia Weekly reports that in recent years, 700 cops have been pulled off the streets. And we spoke to criminologists who say, you know, you're not using the techniques that other cities have used, like up-to-the-minute crime reporting.
Well, what other cities are using it that has cut their crime rate? Because the facts are that it is a national problem that's happening all over the entire nation. So,
well, Chicago and New York would say that they've cut their crime rate by using more enforcement.
Well, if you look at Chicago, and I don't want to compare because Philadelphia is not Chicago, nor is Philadelphia New York, but the facts are that our first 400 homicide happened in 1971. We had 17 years since we had over 400 homicides. One is too many. So we deployed, when we do special units, those special units are still on the street. For the first thing, it takes you 4 or 5 seconds to commit a homicide. It is impossible to get involved or deploy for a 4 or 5 second event. Some of these people that are making these statements are people who haven't been on the street in years and years, but I'm not criticizing what their opinion is. I take full responsibility for what's going on, but at the same time, I says I think some of the other people have to take responsibility for what's going on in the city also.
Well, to be fair, I want to jump in and say that many people are saying that outgoing Mayor Street is a bigger part of the problem, that the witness protection program has been underfunded and that this has impacted the work you've been able to do. But given that, back to where we started with the effort to send citizens into the street, do you worry with the streets so violent, with the witness protection program such a problem, people afraid to come forward and say when they've seen an incident, that you're sending citizens into harm's way?
They're the ones who have volunteered to come out. We're just partnership with them. Okay. Now, if you don't want us to be in harm's way, then don't send us to war. Do not send us anywhere other than Philadelphia, because the fact is that you don't have a problem sending us to Afghanistan. You don't have a problem sending us to Iraq. You didn't have a problem sending us to Vietnam. But when you have men that stand in our own community that we are now tired of what's happening in our community and we want to stand up and volunteer and go out there, then I welcome that help. We had a soldier about 6 months ago. Mother got killed in the city of Philadelphia, was murdered. At the time she was murdered, he was in Iraq. He came back here. He made a public statement, and he says, am I fighting the wrong war? Am I in the wrong location? My mother got murdered in Philadelphia, yet I'm over in Afghanistan fighting for somebody else's freedom. Maybe I should be here fighting for my mother.
Sylvester Johnson has been the police commissioner in the city of Philadelphia since 2002. He'll be retiring January 5th. We're speaking about the program he's joining in a citizens' effort to send citizens into the street to help peace keep. Commissioner Johnson, thanks for speaking with us, and best of luck to you.
All right, thank you very much.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, building a church for atheists, a move to find a place for the world's 1 billion non-believers. That's tomorrow. And before we go today, we'll speak to Amy Bloom about her new novel, Away. You're listening to Here and Now. Hey, wait a minute. Isn't it September 19th? Well, odds, bobs, hammer and tongs, it's International Talk Like a Pirate Day. And so be done. Here to help us brush up, George Kundis, author of The Pirate Primer, Mastering the Language of Swashbucklers and Rogues. George, what prompted this?
Good question, Robin. My wife is still asking me that question every day. It was a trip to Key West. We were on vacation, and we ran into this pirate, came out of nowhere, swinging a sword and screaming pirate profanities at us. And we stumble into him 3 days later. He happens to be the owner of a shop, and he says every time tourists go by, he runs out of the store with his sword in hand and screams profanities at them. And I thought to myself, that's got to be the best job in the world, but there's no manual, if only there were one. And so I took it upon myself to put one together.
Well, and now you have a whole chapter on pirate profanities.
That's right.
Is there one you can share with us that, you know, you can say on the air?
Absolutely. Well, there's a threat, for example. You could say something like, I'll bend a marlin spike round your loaf, or an epithet, which is essentially, you know, calling somebody a bad name. And you could say something like, you're a bilge-sucking, bile-laden son of a scupperlout.
Ooh.
And then, of course, you can sprinkle the rest of your language with all sorts of oaths and curses and all kinds of things.
Well, let's listen to some more. And we must hear from the quintessential pirate himself, Long John Silver.
Shiver my timbers! A landlubber I'll never be!
Robert Newton as Long John Silver in Disney's 1950 film adaptation of Treasure Island. Long John Silver makes many appearances in your book, George. For instance, in the definition of ahoy, which is hello, you reference Long John Silver's using that to greet natives. So, first of all, is there a Long John Silver?
There is no real-life historical Long John Silver. He was the creation of Robert Louis Stevenson in the fantastic novel Treasure Island. But of course, and I have to say it, since it is Talk Like a Pirate Day, there's a little Long John Silver in all of us.
See that this doesn't slip between your clumsy fingers. Tie to the bars. Then jump aboard. We're off to sea.
How else did you do your research? I mean, where else does your information come from?
It came the hard way. I actually reviewed 41 different books, 20 films. I can tell you my wife loved me for that. And 13 television episodes, just to be able to extract every possible pirate word and phrase that's been spoken over the last three centuries. And what I did is boil it down, distill it, explain it, and put it together in one book, and that's what you've got in your hand.
You have one chapter that gets very complicated. It's called Structural Forms. We have split adjective, and then something, what is that, temesis?
Temesis.
What is that?
Temesis is, and we use it all the time in modern English, just no one knows what it's called. You know, we like to use it with the F word a lot, and we basically insert it in the middle of a word. So pirates do it too. So they would say something like, instead of absolutely, you might say something like, abso-floggin-lutely. And it's a way of sandwiching a word that you really like, that you've got some special affinity for, inside a word that you're otherwise using. And it's got impact, and that's why we use it in modern English, Terry.
Okay, George. You write that for pirates, it's good to be bad. Insulting words are used as flattery. What if someone wanted to flatter their boss, what would they say?
They say something like, you're a sightly bucko, that's for sure. You've got more bravado than my colleagues before.
You want to address someone who's cut in front of you in line.
Ah, I'll slaughter you like a hog in springtime.
Let's see. You want to compliment a woman.
What a comely, winsome wench he be. Someone ought her tell God the news. He be missing an angel, he be.
And we have to finally mention the curse. Plague you, sink you.
There's the 12 magic curses, blast ye, blind ye, bone rot ye, burn ye, confound ye, curse ye, damn ye, gut ye, plague ye, rot ye, sink ye, sod ye. But then there's also more specific curses like, curse ye for breathing and eat that falls from my tail.
Did they ever do anything simple like order a sub sandwich or, you know, a tuna on rye?
They absolutely did, but that's the beauty of it. You can say the most ridiculously mundane things. But then you add something at the end that shakes it up. For example, that dog need walking, that's for sure, as my soul's salvation.
You must be a lot of fun around the house, George.
Oh, it's great. It's great.
Well, this is your day. Have a great one.
Thanks a lot. You too.
Yo ho, yo ho.
George Kundis, author of The Pirate Primer, Mastering the Language of Swashbucklers and Rogues. Author Amy Bloom, coming up next, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Away is the story of Lillian Lieb, a seamstress in New York's Lower East Side in 1924, sleeping cheek to jowl with new immigrant friends like Judith in a tenement walk-up, trying to learn a new life even while the old is impossible to forget. Her mother, father, husband, and perhaps her child all killed in a pogrom back in Russia.
Lillian dreams of the murder of her family. She wakes to the sound of her own screaming and to another person's warm body. She eats bread and cabbage with strangers in a small, dirty room. She puts in and takes out stitches to make cheap hats, puts together blue petals and takes apart flawed silk flowers, and she does it all badly. She learns the language of a country that terrifies her so that she can dig deeper into it and make a safe hole for herself because she has no other home. She walks with Judith down Essex Street Saturday nights at 8 o'clock to watch the modern world, to move like an ox among the Americans.
But then a cousin arrives in New York with shattering news. Lillian's daughter Sophie, thought dead, is alive. And Lillian will travel across America up the 300-mile frozen stretch of Alaska called the Telegraph Trail to try to get to Siberia to find her. Author Amy Bloom is a descendant of Jewish Russian immigrants. She says when she asked her grandma what the old village was like, her grandma said, "Not so nice. People just didn't talk about it." So Amy tried to imagine it through her character, Lillian. And Amy Bloom joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Hello.
I want to say at the outset, when I finished this book, I burst into tears. But we're not going to say whether they were tears of joy or sadness. We're not going to give away the ending. Having said that, we read that the story was inspired by a true story of a woman named Lillian Alling in 1927. What was that story?
Well, I think it's true a little bit. There have been some journalists who've tried to track the story of a woman, a Russian woman, who seemed to be intent on walking back to Russia, and that's really as far as anybody knew about her. The fact is, it was not undoable. There were a number of women who hiked the Telegraph Trail for sport, as well as out of necessity.
Right, and that's when your mind started taking off on its own story. Why do you have her going to find a child?
What I remember thinking is, what makes you take the big journey? And I thought to myself, well, what would make me do it? It would only be love, and it would probably be love of a child.
Yeah. In this case, the child, Sophie. Lillian had pushed out the window when this murderous pogrom starts. She was told that Sophie was seen floating in the river. She assumed she was dead. An unbelievable story to read about this murderous night in her home in Russia. And she has recurring nightmares about seeing her mother's cut-off hand. I mean, just horrifying. And the horrifying thought that she doesn't know really what's happened to her daughter. How hard was it for you to live with it?
Well, it was hard to live with, but I also think that in most of the world, things are hard. Terrible, frightening things happen to people. And they live with them, and if they're lucky, they survive them, and they often come to this country and just don't tell anybody any of what they saw in Liberia or Darfur or wherever they were however many years ago. Everybody understands that nobody really wants to hear how bad it was, and everybody wants to hear that you're fine. Mm-hmm. And that's what most people, most immigrants, and most survivors offer the world. So it was hard to live with, but it's certainly nothing compared to what people actually live with.
Mm-hmm. What kind of research did you do research to find the characters that Lillian meets along the way on this incredible trip? There's the railroad porters willing to hide her in a cabinet on a train for maybe a little money or a little sex, the telegraph operators on this telegraph trail in the Northwest living in these little huts.
I did a lot of research on sort of the facts and the circumstances surrounding the characters. The characters were just a pleasure to make up and set forward into their lives. But, you know, I had read a number of books about the telegraph trail, about the kinds of people who became telegraph operators, and were either there for a year, and some of them there for 30 years.
This is how, you know, information was relayed in the early days. I mean, people living in these little huts.
It had a short burst of glory, which was really only about 25 years before radio completely took over. It was very, very necessary. I researched the telegraph operators and the telegraph trail. I certainly you know, researched African-American life in Seattle in the 1920s, and also the idea that there were a number of families of con men and grifters for whom this is a multi-generational activity, whether they are gypsies or all-American con men or the Chinese grifters. And I liked the idea of this being a family business.
Right. And you also use a device, again, as Lillian meets these characters as she goes along, soon after they have some adventure, misadventure together, you then take a moment and write the end of their story. We have to wait till the very end to hear Lillian's, but a fellow female prisoner, Lillian serves some time, ends up, you tell us, running a respectable hardware store, a black prostitute who murders her pimp, converts and becomes a respected member of Hadassah. Why do you do that? Why do you take that moment to tell us what happens to them?
Well, because they are none of them minor characters to me. They are all big characters. They all deserve their own novels. And one of the things that I wanted the opportunity to do was to tell sort of a 19th century story in the sense of a big story, a big, dense story with a lot of wonderful characters in a different format where you could play around with time and location and where I could just sort of move through time like a river and send these little tributaries forward and then come back to the central story. And also, when I was a little kid, I loved 19th century fiction. I loved the idea of the epilogue, and I wanted to weave it into the novel rather than make it a postscript.
You know, in a way, too, it's sort of insight into a writer's head, because as we understand it, you often know that whole story, mm-hmm. even if you don't put it in the book.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And a lot of the backstory, you know, one is well advised to skip. You know, the reader doesn't need to hear all that throat clearing. But the idea of what happens next and that people have a future that exists off the page was always very appealing to me as a reader and therefore as a writer.
Yeah. A couple thoughts. Again, we are not giving away the ending for those who are reading this straight through as I did. You will never look at an elderly immigrant couple again the same way. If you did before, you will now think even more about what is that? What is the story? But also, again, we don't want to give away the ending, but if people wanted another ending, have you heard from readers? I mean, what?
I'm sure that the endings that people wish for reflect the endings that they wish for, which is perfectly understandable. This is the ending for the book that made sense to me. I am a great believer in love and even the possibility of romance, not so much in sentimentality.
Amy Bloom, the book is Away. By the way, Away, meaning?
I guess it's not a very fancy title. I did have fancier titles, but in the end, a lot of what I find myself thinking about is that there are really only two stories in the world, which is I go on a journey or a stranger comes to town. And either way, someone is coming from away and going away.
Yeah, Lillian is going to her daughter, but she's going away from her past, even as she's going to it in the form of her
right.
daughter.
I mean, really the heart of this is when I was a little kid, I lived near an airport, and I would look at the signs that said arriving and departing, which threw me in a complete tailspin because I would think, well, surely if you are arriving, it meant that you were departing. And surely if you're departing, you would have had to have arrived first. That's sort of how I feel about away. No matter which way you are going, you're going away.
Amy Bloom, the book is Away. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.